the disgrace of being accused of being raped by a slave, or even have been raped at all, even if they could prove Tarquin to have been the perpetrator. We have the martial model of Horatius Cocles, patriot, gallant warrior, who single-handedly holds off the Etruscan army, risks his own life to save the state. That's a great model of martial prowess. We have in the first consul, Lucius Junius Brutus, the man considered generally to have been the founder of the Republic since he organized the coup d'etat that ousted the Tarquins. We have in him another rather more difficult model for us in the modern world to understand, but a model of what the Romans considered a most admirable quality, the quality of severitas, the quality of sticking by your principles, regardless of how hard it might be. And this centres on what I mentioned earlier, the attempted restoration of the monarchy from within Rome. Because what I didn't say was that the leaders of that attempted restoration were the sons of Brutus. And Brutus, as the magistrate, had to preside over the execution of his own sons, which he did. Now, we might find that somewhat disturbing, but for the Romans, this is a model of severitas, standing firm beside your principles, which are the principles now of liberty and freedom in the face of monarchic oppression, even if it means executing your own children. Moral tales. What do we do with these moral tales? Modern scholars have come up with various explanations. For those who believe in the wider Etruscan political control of central Italy, then naturally enough, the expulsion of the Tarquins fits into the waning power of the Etruscans in central Italy. Enough of that. I don't need to go into that anymore. There are others who take a rather more extreme view. They simply dismiss completely the legends and moral tales surrounding the expulsion of the kings and say, no. What we have going on is not a single catastrophic revolutionary event, like the expulsion of the Tarquins, but rather a process of evolution. In other words, what we have is a gradual process of the devolution of the king's power to annual magistrates. And eventually the king is sort of phased out of the picture. This process going on for maybe 70 or 80 years. Some of them argue even that it goes down right down to 450 BC. Okay, so it's a long process of evolution that's basically being ignored completely by the Roman sources and presented instead as this single event surrounded by all these wonderful romantic tales. That view doesn't carry much weight among the majority of scholars. It's considered to be too extreme. Another view is to see in the story of Lucretia events that are not, in fact, entirely improbable. This approach would say that within royal dynasties, personal acts can actually have tremendous political consequences. It's not unlikely that the transgression of that nature by a prince against a noblewoman's wife might have severe political ramifications for the dynasty as a whole. They would point to other well-documented dynasties, for those of you perhaps who have seen or heard Professor Jeremy McInerney's course on ancient Greece. You may be familiar with the stories of the expulsion of the tyrants from Greece. The tyrant Hippias is driven out of Athens, He's driven out of Athens over a lover's quarrel between himself and his brother and three other men. So here's an event that has a personal quality but has severe political ramifications for the tyranny at Athens. So similarly goes the argument, it's quite possible that something like this actually took place and that it was a personal event that led to the Tarquin's expulsion. The view that I find the most intriguing is one that peeks through now and then from the ancient sources, an alternative tradition about the end of the monarchy. That tradition, which is mentioned in a few Roman sources, records that Lars Porsena, the Etruscan king of Clusium, captured Rome. He actually took it, and then, presumably, he abolished the monarchy and established the republic. Why he did so, or so on, that's not clear. All we get are vague hints that this took place. In the end, it has to be said that the evidence we have isn't sufficiently clear for us to make a definite determination among these competing possibilities. But once again, we have competing possibilities. Whatever the case, when the Tarquins were expelled, the fledgling republic began to adopt its distinctive shape, and it's perhaps worth looking at that. As we'll see, the Republic, the Roman Republic, during its long period of existence, went through a very protracted process of evolution in terms of its polity, in terms of the shape of its government. And naturally enough, the very earliest phases of it are somewhat unclear, but the broad outline seems to be generally agreed upon by most scholars in the field. Essentially, the kings are replaced by two annually elected magistrates, who are called consuls, or possibly praetors, which the latter phrase, praetor, seems to be a form of magistracy that's found within Etruscan cities. Maybe that the Romans adopted that term first to indicate these two annually elected magistrates. In other words, you have two men, as I mentioned at the start, the first two are Junius Brutus and Collatinus. These two men are the first consuls, and then every year there are new elections and they're replaced. I'm going to call them consuls for the sake of clarity. I don't want to keep saying consuls or praetors, but just to let you know, one example of the uncertainty surrounding this earlier period is that we're not even really clear what these guys were called at the start, either consuls or praetors. What's noteworthy straight away about this system of government is that two basic principles that were to forever mark office holding in Republican Rome are established at the very outset. You have a limited tenure of office of 1 year's duration, and you always have at least one other colleague, one other person with the same powers as yourself holding that office. So collegiality, having at least one colleague and only holding the office for a limited period of time, limited tenure of office, these two principles, if we believe our sources, were established right at the start. There's no reason to disbelieve it. Again, comparative data from Greece would suggest that this is quite common. Kings being replaced by annual magistrates, quite common. How do we know who the consuls were? Well, the Romans kept a list of them. They're called fasti, and they're a matter of considerable debate and uncertainty. The fasti are lists, year by year, of who the consuls were. And they seem to have gone back to the very start, back to 509 BC. There are two views on the believability of the fasti, the skeptical view and the more trusting view. The skeptical view is that the fasti have suffered, especially the earliest years of it, prior to about 280 BC, have suffered from interpolation from later periods. Skeptics point out that you have families who are in better documented times prominent among the list of consuls, have nothing going back for centuries, and then suddenly one of them appears in the very earliest lists. They say this is clearly a case of later families sticking their names into the past to get themselves better historical credentials. The more trusting people take the diametrically opposite view from the same evidence. This is what's so fascinating about this, I find. It's so typical of ancient history. The diametrically opposite view. They point to the opposite case and say, hang on, you have consuls in the early lists with names that never appear again. Why invent people who are nobodies? Surely the names must reflect historical reality. You decide. Whatever the case, later Romans had a list of consuls so they could tell year by year who the consuls were, and it went all the way back to 509 BC, right back to the supposed start of the Republic. In addition to the consuls then, we have already seen that there was the Comitia Curiata from the regal period, and possibly stretching back to the regal period, the other assembly of the people, the Comitia Centuriata, the assembly of people organized into centuries. And these two popular assemblies remained and became, in fact, cornerstones of the new republic. For it was the Comitia Centuriata, the centuriate assembly, the military assembly, if you want to think of it that way, that elected the consuls every year. And the Comitia Curiata are the ones who conferred imperium on the consuls, as they had done on the kings. So, if you want to think of it this way, on one day, the citizens would assemble in their centuries to hold elections for the consuls. Once the two consuls had been elected, on some other subsequent day, the same people would assemble again, but this time in their curiae, to confer and ratify the choice and confer imperium on the consuls. Remember, imperium always comes from the Roman people. That's another key concept of the Roman Republic. The consuls then basically replaced the king. they took over the main judicial and military functions of the king. But the Romans were a highly practical people. They said sometimes in emergencies, it's not going to be possible to have two commanders with equal power. You might have a gridlock situation at a crucial moment when a firm hand is needed. So they allowed for a temporary monarchy, if you like. They worked into the early republic a system that allowed for, in extreme circumstances, the appointment of a man called a dictator, a man who spoke and people listened. That's the idea behind it. And he was an extraordinary magistrate. He was chosen from among the members of the Senate. Precisely how this early period is unclear. In later years, he was nominated from among the ex-consuls. And he did not have a colleague. And his job was to sort out the particular problem that he'd been appointed to sort out. So he was only chosen in extraordinary circumstances and given the job, fix that. That was his job. He appointed, below him, the dictator appointed an assistant called the Master of Horse, the Magister Equitum, the Master of the Cavalry, which suggests that the original function of this office was definitely military. It was to sort out the, or at least obviate the possibility that two consuls who didn't like each other or who disagreed about how the war should continue would gridlock the Roman effort in that war and appoint a definite general to carry out a specific task. So once again, the dictatorship is to carry out a specific task and is appointed only in extraordinary circumstances. In addition to the dictator, the king's religious duties devolved onto the nobility, and specifically the old pre-existing college of the pontiffs, the pontifices, who were probably around from the regal period, and the chief of the pontifical college, the Pontifex Maximus, now rose up as the chief priest of Rome. He basically took over much of the king's duties in the religious sphere. And so he became the chief priest. And forever afterwards, the Pontifex Maximus was the chief priest of Rome. He's the one chiefly responsible for maintaining the good relationship with the gods. We will look at in the later lecture at the system of Roman paganism, its belief system, and the way that it was administered by the various officials who ran it. But suffice it to say right now that the priestly colleges were not made up of any separate entity or any separate class from the politicians. It's the nobility who provide Rome with its politicians, its generals, and its priests. They're all the same people. One can be a priest and a general and a consul all at the same time. Okay? So that's an important point as well to appreciate early on. The king himself is generally agreed to have survived in vestigial form in the position of the Rex Sacrorum, the king of the sacred rites. Why this should be so was unclear. Various arguments have been put forward. The relationship between the Pontifex Maximus and the king of the sacred rites has been discussed. I won't go into all those details. It's a very, very fine and detailed argument that we don't have to delve into. But suffice it to say that I think the majority view is safely that the Rex Sacrorum, this king of the sacred rites, is a vestige of the old king. Depoliticized. Because rather interestingly, unlike all the other priests, the Rex Sacrorum is not allowed to be a member of the Senate. His duties are specifically religious and he's essentially excluded from the political life of the state, which would, I think, support the view that the Rex Sacrorum is in fact the sort of stripped down king, the king divested of his political power, but still responsible for various religious duties. Such then is, broadly speaking, the roughly agreed upon shape of the early republic, he says, qualifying himself at every turn. So many of these issues are a matter of debate and uncertainty. I'm presenting you with what I believe to be the majority view in most of these cases. We have seen in the previous lecture on regal society the appearance of the order called the patriciate, or the patrician order, the Latin word ordo, once again referring to a rank, a social status, social rank. And it seems that in the early republic we have the appearance for the first time of the other order that was to become dominant in the early republic and influence the shaping of the early republic and politics of this period, and that is the plebeian order. In our ancient sources, the plebeians are presented as always being there. They were there alongside the patricians. And they were constituted of everybody else. All the people, at least all the freeborn citizen body, who were not patricians, were classified as plebeians. It has struck certain scholars as extremely curious that they should be described as an order. Why not just call them everyone else? Because the order really implies some sort of organization, some kind of a limitation on membership. And so it seems to be the case, at least it's been argued forcefully, that the plebeians are in fact a rather more restricted, originally rather more restricted body of citizens who grow up in opposition to, perhaps as a foil to the patricians at some early stage, and they seem to have their own socio-political agenda. Precisely who these plebeians were, we just can't say, we just don't have the evidence available to us, especially since the Romans believed that the plebeians were always there, it confuses the matter all the more. But a good case can be made that the plebeians arose in the early Republic in, not quite in opposition to, but parallel to the patrician class with their own socio-political agenda. Whether or not there were rich and influential families originally in the plebeian order is a matter of some discussion. The case seems to be that the richer, non-patrician, richer families of Rome joined the plebeian order later. Because, as we'll see in the next lecture, in the course of a major formative event in the early Republic, what the Romans called the struggle of the orders, the plebeians began agitating for certain privileges, certain rights, reforms and changes in the way the state was run. And our evidence would suggest that initially those first motives for agitation were of a socio-economic nature, which would apply to the lesser well-off people in Roman society, and so the argument goes the plebeians were originally the less influential non-patrician families, who in the course of the struggle of the orders joined forces with richer non-patrician families to form the final plebeian order of the later era. But that's a story which we should postpone to the next lecture.
Lecture 8, The Struggle of the Orders.
Hello and welcome back to the History of Ancient Rome, Lecture 8 in the series. The last time we examined the foundation of the Roman Republic, and we saw that the problems of evidence that dog the investigation of early Roman history continue unabated for that particular issue as well. Things don't get terribly much better when we come to look at the early Republic, which continues in our sources to contain stories that are clearly models of ethical, moral behaviour rather than historical accounts, or at least clearly historical accounts of events. Nevertheless, one thing does shine through from the evidence, and that is a conflict, a socio-political conflict that started very early in the Republic's history and continued for the best part of two centuries on and off, and was considered by the Romans to have shaped, in no small order, to have shaped their Republic in a decisive way. That struggle is referred to as the struggle of the orders, or the conflict of the orders sometimes, and refers to a ongoing debate and conflict between the patricians and the plebeians over numerous issues. What I want to do today in our lecture is to examine the broad outline of the struggle, see how it's presented to us in the ancient authors that we have available to us, try to reconstruct what actually was going on in the background. There are hints in the sources that something more complicated than they portray was in progress, and then finally look at the resolution of the conflict and look at its ramifications for later Roman history. In our sources, the struggle of the orders is presented overwhelmingly as a political struggle over access to the higher offices of the Roman state and to the political system of the Roman Republic. Many scholars find this very suspicious, since the course of the struggle in our sources seems to reflect very closely the course of a better documented and later conflict in the Roman Republic, which eventually was to bring about the collapse of the Republic, and is referred to by modern scholars as the Roman Revolution, a process that started in 133 BC and continued down to 31 BC. That's a process that we'll be giving very detailed attention to in due course. But many scholars find it suspicious that the struggle of the orders looks so much like the Roman Revolution. And what they conclude from this is that the later authors have retrojected a familiar pattern of political conflict back into a distant, ill-documented past. Other scholars argue differently and say, well, goodness, the rather restricted scope of political conflict and political discourse in ancient Roman society probably means that they argued over much the same sort of thing, whether it was in 400 BC or 100 BC. So whether or not you adhere to one view or the other is again a matter of how you approach, how you interpret the evidence. But I think it is a cause for some suspicion to see that the struggle of the orders is presented to us as sort of earlier version of the Roman Revolution. Our sources present it as a relatively straightforward dispute over access to the higher offices of the state between the plebeians and the patricians. They portray the patricians as dominating the consulship, for instance, and the plebeians as agitating continuously to get in on the consulship and the upper offices of state, eventually being admitted. But there are some hints in our sources that the struggle of the orders ran something deeper than this, and it's on those deeper issues that I would like to turn our attention now. In addition to access to the political system, which is, as I say, the dominant theme that comes through from our written evidence, we also hear that the plebs were demanding relief from debt, and specifically a form of debt that is known as debt bondage. Now, debt bondage is a rather complex procedure. It isn't that you go along to your bank manager, ask for a chariot loan, and then when you fail to pay, you become a slave. Debt bondage is actually a means that's used in archaic societies, usually one that lacks masses of slave labour, to acquire for the upper classes cheap labour by provision of subsistence to poor or destitute people in return for their work. And the work is normally prescribed as a form of servitude, a form of slavery, and it seems it can be abused. Once you find yourself in debt bondage, it can be very difficult to get out because you're in a spiral of being dependent upon someone who's supplying you with your subsistence and for whom you have to continually work in order to survive. And one can find oneself quickly as a slave, apparently as a full-blown slave, even though you're technically a sort of indentured servant. As a result, debt bondage was something that would definitely have affected the lower orders of society. If you had a bad crop and you needed subsistence, you could find yourself caught in the cycle of debt bondage and obligated to a rich or more influential person. This is something then that the plebs were agitating for reform. They also appeared to have been agitating for judicial reform in the form of some codification of the laws. We have seen how in the regal period the king was the font of all law. In the absence of the king, when the king was removed, it was the chief magistrates of the state who now became the font of all law. They're the ones who decided on judicial matters. And apparently their treatment of the lower orders could be arbitrary. As a result, the plebs were agitating for a codification of the law, some form of written, agreed-upon law that applies to everyone equally, so that people would know their rights and know their positions on certain issues when they came before a magistrate. Again, this is another issue that would seem to affect the lower orders rather than the upper orders. There also seems to have been a demand for the distribution of land from the newly conquered territories. We'll be turning our attention in the next lecture to the expansion of Rome in Italy. As Roman power expanded, more and more land came within the ambit of the Roman state, and there was a demand from the plebs that this land be distributed evenly and that the upper classes don't just grab everything for themselves. So really what we're talking about is not so much a struggle of the orders, but the struggles of the orders over a variety of different issues. And the earliest ones appear to have been the socio-economic issues of debt bondage, generally relief from debt, later then land distribution and access to the political system. So it's a much more complicated picture than our sources tend to present it. although they do present hints of these other aspects of the struggle at various points in their accounts. It must be stated that we don't really have a consistent account of the struggle of the orders, rather a series of snippets of information, vignettes, if you like, references to it and so forth, which makes working on it extremely difficult indeed. The early Republic was dominated, for sure, by the patricians, but the notion that the patricians had always dominated the state doesn't seem to be true. If we turn to the Fasti, the lists of consuls, the annual lists of consuls, we can see that in the period from the foundation of the Republic, if we start at 509 BC and take the story down to about 400 or so, we can see that in that period, at the start, plebeians, it seemed, were given access to the higher office of the state, but that gradually in the course of the 5th century, their access to that system was closed off. This pattern of office holding is often called the closing of the patriciate. This is the time at which the patricians cease to accept new members into their order and start to attempt to monopolize the higher offices of state, giving rise to the demand for access to the political system. But it can be noted from the percentages of office holding by patricians and by plebeians over this time that the closing of the patriciate only becomes really pronounced in the middle of the 5th century BC. So, therefore, the demand for access to the political system seems to have come into the struggle of the orders later. It seems to have come in as a secondary issue. Because we hear from our sources that prior to 450 or so BC, there was already signs of trouble in the state. The issues agitating the plebs must have been other than access to the political system, since they hadn't been shut out from the upper offices at that early stage. The first real event in the struggle of the orders that we hear about takes place in 494 BC. In this year, we hear that the plebs demanded relief from debt and debt bondage, which they were finding oppressive. They also wanted some relief from arbitrary treatment at the hands of the aristocrats. This would tend to suggest then that the plebs were originally constituted of the socially and economically depressed elements in society. When their demands were not met, they resorted to a very interesting ploy. They seceded from Rome. They simply walked out of the gates over to a neighbouring hill, the Janiculum, and left the city empty. This is at least how it's portrayed. Suddenly we have patricians sitting around in Rome, and there are no plebeians to treat arbitrarily or to subject to debt bondage. And whether they actually did that, whether they actually physically left the city and just abandoned it, would seem most unlikely, since Rome was at war with various neighbours at this time, and those neighbours would have taken tremendous advantage of the complete absence of the rank and file of the Roman army, but that some sort of a protest, civic protest, took place would seem to be what the secession was actually about. In any case, our traditions record that they simply left the city and set up shop on the Janiculum Hill, where they established a parallel state, the plebeian state, we'll call it, which they modelled closely on the Republic, on the patrician-dominated Republic, in the following way. We have seen already that in the Republic there were two popular assemblies organised on centuries, that is to say military units called centuries. That was called the Assembly of Centuries, the Centuriate Assembly. We've seen also that there was an assembly organized around curiae, another grouping of citizens. That's most unclear to us, the assembly of curiae, or curiate assembly. But just like this, the plebeians set up their own assembly, which they called the Council of the Plebs, the Concilium Plebis. Plebs only allowed, of course. So they set up a parallel to the popular assemblies. And they organized this, it seems, along the tribal lines, the divisions of people into local units of tribes. Now, that's certainly how it was organized later, but whether it was organized like that at the very start, at its inception, that's a different matter, but that's certainly how it was organized in later years. So, as you have voting blocks in the Republic's Comitia Centuriata and Curiata, likewise you have voting blocks in the Council of the Plebs. Just as the Republic had its magistrates, the two annually elected consuls, so too the plebs gave themselves their own officers, who they called tribunes, which seems to mean tribal officers, since the assembly that elected them was based on tribal units, then the tribunes were tribal officers. They're called tribunes of the plebs. Just as there were two consuls, there were initially two tribunes. The purpose of the tribunes was to represent the interests of the plebs and to defend their interests against their opponents. The plebs also, however, elected two further officers called aediles, who were assistants to the tribunes. They were called aediles of the plebs. They were a new thing. They hadn't been seen before, and they first appeared in the context of the plebeian state in this early secession from Rome. And just like the Roman Republic, the plebeians would meet in their council. They would have propositions put to them by their officers, and they would vote on those propositions. When those propositions were passed, they were called plebiscita, plebiscites. These are decisions of the plebs, resolutions of the plebs. Initially binding only on the plebs, of course, since no one else recognized them, but eventually we'll see the plebeian state came to be integrated into the republic to give us the fully developed Roman Republic, the fully developed Roman state. All this is presented to us as happening in 494. It mightn't have actually all happened in that time. This, again, may be a process of evolution. The first secession marks out the plebs as being separate from the patricians. They're agitating for political and social and judicial justice. And then they start to organize themselves in this parallel state. It may well have been a gradual process. It mightn't have happened all in the summer of 494. But whatever the case, in the course of the early 5th century, a plebeian state emerges parallel to the patrician-dominated republic. Exactly how the situation was resolved in 494 and in the years following it is unclear to us from our sources, so we just have to leave that situation sit. The plebeian agitation continued, however, the struggle of the orders did not end. And the next real, I suppose, marking point, the next big benchmark of the struggle of the orders takes place in the mid-5th century, in the years between 451 and 449 BC, which also marks a hallmark in Roman legal history. In this time, the plebeian demands for a codification of the laws was ongoing. It was decided, in a rather wonderful tradition in the Romans, it was decided that they would send over an embassy to Athens to examine how the Athenians had codified their laws under their great leader Solon years before. Armed with these wonderful plans and ideas, this embassy came back, and it was decided in 451 that a board of 10 men would be established to codify the laws of the state. Now, for reasons that are completely unclear to us, it was also decided that while this board was in power, the regular constitution of the government would be suspended. There would be no consuls. There would just be this board of 10 to codify the laws. Headed by one of the earliest personalities that we can grasp from Roman history, a man called Appius Claudius, the board of 10 sets about its job and produces 10 tables, that means 10 tablets, that were put up in public of laws in 451 BC. It seems, however, that agitation for further reform continued, so it was decided that the Board of Ten should continue its work into the following year. The board was re-elected, Appius Claudius again at its head, but something went terribly wrong in the second year of the board's tenure of office. They became a junta of sorts who tried to take over the state. They went around behaving arbitrarily, making judicial decisions against people without any full justification, marching around with all the symbols of power of imperium, even though they weren't entitled to them, and so on, until they became known, rather colourfully, as the Ten Tarquins. They published 2 more tables of law, bringing the total to 12, and then refused to step down from power. In this crisis, the plebs seceded a second time. They simply left and said, well, if you want to rule a city, rule an empty one. And they departed a second time and forced the 10 Tarquins, the board of 10 for codifying the laws, to step down. Appius Claudius was imprisoned and committed suicide before facing trial for his crimes. The result of this process was that the plebeian state was recognized by the republic. In many ways, the plebeian state, or the action of the plebs, had saved the state from tyranny. And so whatever about the original status of the plebeian state vis-a-vis the republic, by 450 it was recognized and came to be, well, folded in to the republic in a certain way. Well, the struggle of the owners continued. There were still further demands for relief from debt, land distribution and so forth. And now at this stage, the patriciate had closed. Rich non-patrician families now, it seems, allied themselves with what was a very effective political tool in the state, the plebeian order, and changed the face of the plebeian order and began agitating now for access to the political system. Without going into the details of it as well, most of the details are most unclear to us. By 367 BC, many of the social and economic problems that faced the struggle of the orders had been resolved. A series of laws were passed in this year in 367 that ended much of the struggle's political aspect. At this time, for instance, it was decided that one of the consuls every year had to be a plebeian. So it was mandated by law that the plebeians had access to the political system. In addition, in full recognition of the plebeian state, the patricians created their own parallels to the plebeian officers. They didn't create tribunes, but they created two more aediles who were to be only patricians. So now you're going to have four aediles a year. Two of them will be curule aediles, that means patrician aediles, because they sit in a certain kind of chair called a curule chair, ivory inlay chair, apparently an Etruscan style of chair that was used as the kingly throne among the Etruscans. Only patricians could use such a chair when sitting in office. And then two plebeian aediles. In addition, a new magistracy was created, the praetorship, to be below the consulship, to be one step below, and this new magistracy was to be open to both orders equally. So the struggle of the orders, really in its essence, ended by 367 BC in its bitterest form, sees at the end the inclusion of the plebeians, the folding of the plebeian state into the patrician-dominated republic to form what is essentially the Roman Republic that we all know and love from later years, and which we'll be looking at in more detail later in this course. There was a postscript to, well, there's one point I wish to make before moving on to that, however, which is that it should be noted that whereas one consul a year was mandated to be plebeian, the inverse was not the case. It was not mandated that one consul a year had to be patrician. So it was possible to have two plebeian consuls, but impossible to have two patrician consuls. A postscript to the struggle of the orders comes in 287 BC. In this time, up to this time, as we've seen, despite the recognition of the plebeian state by the patrician-dominated republic, the plebiscites of the plebs seem to have been binding only on themselves. There's some discussion. How did they enforce their decisions? How did the council of the plebs enforce its resolutions? And it would seem that it would be through threat of civil disobedience. If people refused to accept their decisions, then they could always secede, or they could refuse to cooperate with whatever order had been issued to them. And if they were in any way challenged, well, they could call on their tribunes, on their officers who represented their interests to help them. This is an extremely confrontational mode of doing things. By 287 BC, it was clear that this was no longer going to work, and so a law was passed which mandated that the decisions of the plebs were binding, the plebiscites were binding on all citizens. In other words, the plebiscites now gained the force of law. And this was to have very important constitutional ramifications in the Roman state. What it meant was that the Council of the Plebs was now a legislative body of the state. It could pass, essentially, laws that were applicable to all people in the state. I should point out, by the way, that the 12 tables, which were instituted in 451 and 450 BC, have no longer survived. They are the first body of Roman law. They haven't survived intact, but they have survived in fragments, in quotations, in later authors, since these were basic texts that all Roman schoolboys learned by heart when they were in school. And they have been reconstructed because people will say in table one, as the law in table one says, wah, 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 as the law in table two says. And so scholars have put them all together and they've come up with at least a partial reconstruction of the 12 tables of Roman law. And they're a fascinating document. They're one of our earliest documents on Roman history. They date to the middle of the 5th century BC. And they tell us that a lot of the features of Roman society that the Romans considered to be very old were indeed extremely old. In the 12 tables, we find mentions of slavery and debt bondage. We find mention of patricians, obviously, and plebeians. So these are obviously going back at least into the 5th century. And we find also mention of patrons and clients, another key feature of Roman society that I've mentioned, clientela. This also is a feature of the society that the 12 tables was written for. That the tables as cited in these authors are valid and not just inventions of later ages is suggested by the very archaic nature of the Latin that's used in these quotations. When an author cites as table X says about this particular subject and then quotes the table, it'll be in a very old-fashioned style of Latin, one that would not be current at the time that the author was writing, and this suggests that these citations are actually from 12 tables of law that were put up in the 5th century. And allow us to see that we're not completely off the mark. It's nice to have a check in the sea of uncertainty from the written sources. Nice to have a check like that to show that we're not completely off the mark when we reconstruct the broad shape of these early conflicts in the Roman Republic and the shape of society as a whole. Well, the struggle of the orders, as I say, largely completed by 367, but definitely nailed into its coffin in 287 with the Lex Hortensia, the law that mandated that the plebiscites, that the decisions of the plebs be binding on all citizens. This struggle had enormous effects on the Roman state. It changed the way things were done in the Roman state. It introduced new elements into the Roman governmental system. The elements of the Council of the Plebs, Tribunes of the Plebs, and Aediles and Plebiscites. All these originally separatist, I suppose, or secessionist patterns of behaviour by the plebs came to be folded into the Republic and became part and parcel of doing things in the Roman state. That was to have enormous ramifications in the Roman Revolution. With the closing of the patriciate and then the access gained by the rich non-patrician families, the plebeian families, into the upper echelons of the state with the laws of 367 BC, the nature of the Roman ruling class was also transformed. If the plebeians had started out as the lower orders of society agitating for social and economic and judicial justice, when they were joined by the rich upper class, non-patrician elements, they were transformed. The plebeians themselves came to be transformed. When the rich plebs got what they wanted, which was access to the political system, they melded with the patricians to form what's often called the patrician plebeian ruling class. Roman historians don't have a tremendous amount of imagination. So the joint ruling class of the later Roman state is often called the patrician plebeian ruling class. What this meant was that the upper orders now looked to their own interests, and the rich plebeians tended to disregard the agitation from the lower orders, since they had gotten what they wanted. What they wanted was a slice of the cake, and they had been given that slice, and now whether or not debt bondage was a problem, whether or not there was widespread debt, the distribution of land and so forth, those issues no longer concerned them, because they were now in the club of ruling the state. This was to have also severe ramifications for the future, because many of the issues that had agitated the plebs in the first place were not addressed. Although, to be sure, in 326 BC, debt bondage was abolished, but debt wasn't. Debt and land distribution continued to be burning issues for the lower orders of the Roman state and were to reappear in the Roman Revolution as serious stimuli to action. With the melding of the patricians and the plebeians into a single ruling order, the nature of the Roman elite also changed. The distinction between plebeian and patrician became far less important politically. It was still a socially powerful division. Remember, one was a patrician by one's name, and as a result, you could have some cachet by your name, but the distinction between patrician and plebeian was no longer so important politically. pretty much the running of the state was open to both patricians and plebeians. What became more important now was relative wealth. The new Roman nobility came to be formulated around relative wealth, concepts of, I suppose, plutocracy in many ways. All wealthy citizens, whether they be patricians or plebeians, could stand for the offices of state and the consulship and so forth. So the patrician-plebeian division recedes as an important political entity in the wake of the law of 287 BC, and a new Roman nobility is what emerges to rule the empire, which over the whole time that I've been talking about today was an ongoing endeavour, and it is to the rise of Roman power in Italy that we'll turn our attention in the next lecture.
Lecture 9, Roman Expansion in Italy.
Welcome to the 9th lecture in the history of ancient Rome. The last time we examined the struggle of the orders, an internal domestic dispute within the Roman Republic, the fledgling Republic, although it lasted some 200 years. And I mentioned at the end that throughout the period that we were focused on the internal workings of the Roman state, externally the Romans were extremely active militarily. And it's to their expansion within Italy that I want to turn to today. Roman expansion in Italy can basically be broken down into three phases. First of all, a long, long period of gaining control over their immediate neighbours, the Latins, in the plain of Latium, south of Rome. That process really coming to a close in the middle of the 4th century BC, and then the Romans turning their attention in earnest to central Italy, and specifically the difficult mountainous terrain of Samnium, and the even more difficult, obdurate inhabitants of that area, the Samnites, who are fearsome warriors indeed, gave the Romans quite a run for their money in three wars, which saw Rome eventually extend its power into central Italy. And then finally, Rome moving south and gaining control over the Greek colonies in the south on the mainland, not in Sicily. That's to be a different story. Basically, we'll start this lecture with the Romans battling with their immediate neighbours and leave them in control of the entire Italian peninsula south of the Po Valley. The stories of the Roman kings contain numerous legends and tales of the kings fighting their Latin neighbours. In fact, gaining control of Latium proved to be Rome's most difficult task. It was an enterprise that went on for the best part of 4 centuries. In this time, in the earliest sources, we have accounts of kings mixing war and diplomacy, sometimes attacking, sometimes signing treaties with their immediate neighbours. We hear that, or at least we get hints, that the transition from monarchy to republic somewhat weakened the Roman position. Remember the story of Lars Porsena attacking Rome shortly after the expulsion of the Tarquins, and in the one version of that tradition, taking the city, capturing it. But they restored equilibrium, at least they restored their control over the Latins with the Battle of Lake Regillus in 499 BC, which is presented to us as the third and final attempt of Tarquinius Superbus to gain entrance back into Rome. But as far as external affairs goes, it allows us to see the Romans restoring their position of dominance, or at least restoring their position of high influence over their immediate neighbours in Latium. Shortly after the Battle of Lake Regillus came a landmark in their dealings with the Latins, which has come down to us as the Foedus Cassianum, the Treaty of Cassius, named after the man who signed it. This treaty is presented to us in outline in some of our sources, some others give us some details, and we hear, I think this is somewhat encouraging, we hear from a offhand remark in Cicero, writing in the 1st century BC then, that a copy of this treaty was to be seen and read in the forum in his day, which suggests, as we mentioned earlier, that probably accessible to many of our later authors was material far older, which is now lost to us, but which they had access to, may, to some degree, offset our suspicions as to the reliability about these early events. However, the outline of the treaty is pretty much as follows. Essentially, the Treaty of Cassius was a mutual non-aggression pact. It was a military alliance in which the Romans and the Latins agreed that they would not attack each other, that they would treat as enemies and friends the same people, so they would unite together and defend each other if need be. Perhaps most importantly, they would share equally all the spoils of any wars that they undertook together. The treaty also seems to have stipulated that in the case of any joint enterprises, Romans would command joint forces. The greatest uncertainty surrounds the issue of whether or not the Romans are to be seen as being equal to the Latins in this treaty, whether or not they are members of what modern scholars call the Latin League, the agreement of individual Latin states to work together. So whether the Romans are a member of that league, just one vote among many, for instance, or whether the Romans stand outside the league, and the Treaty of Cassius is a bilateral agreement between the Romans and all of the Latins organized into their league, which would give the Romans a much greater influence and control over events. The latter seems to be the case, so far as we can tell, especially from the stipulation that joint forces are to be commanded by Romans. In the years then following the signing of the treaty, actually starting slightly beforehand, we'll say roughly from 500 BC down to about 440 BC, the Romans and the Latins found themselves very occupied with fighting off incursions from the mountain dwellers to their east and their south. Tribal cultures called Aequi and Volsci, tough tribal fighters who would come down from the mountains in the campaigning season and raid the fertile plains, even on occasion reaching the outskirts of the city of Rome itself. The Romans are joining up with the Latins to face this threat together and are pretty much in constant, continuous, annual warfare with these tribal peoples. Since Romans commanded joint forces, this process of continuous warfare helped give the Romans a sense of ascendancy over their Latin neighbors. At the same time as they were fighting off the Volsci and Aequi to the south in defensive campaigns, the Romans were energetically embarked on campaigns across the Tiber to the north against their Etruscan neighbours, particularly the Etruscan town of Veii, which was considerably more powerful than Rome at this early stage, talking now in the 5th century BC, and allowed the conflict to go on for quite a protracted period of time. Having repulsed the Aequi and the Volsci sufficiently so that the threat was neutralized, the Romans more energetically turned their attentions towards the north, using Latin, combined Latin and Roman armies to attack their northern neighbors. And by 396 BC, they had proven themselves very successful. In fact, they captured and destroyed Veii. But in an act of unbridled greed, the Romans took all the spoils of that war for themselves. This act of arrogance was on the point of causing warfare between the Latins and the Romans, between their Latin allies and the Romans, when disaster struck from the north. We have seen that the area of the Po Valley in northern Italy was considered by the Romans not to be part of Italy at all. They named it Gallia Cisalpina, Gaul this side of the Alps, because this area, what we consider to be the country of Italy today, the northern plain, was in that time occupied by Celtic tribesmen, Gauls. In 390 BC, a large force of Gauls came out of Gallia Cisalpina and headed south. A Roman force and Latin force, hastily drawn together to block this threat, was crushed at the Battle of the River Allia, and Rome lay open to the Gallic invaders. In outline, the Gauls took the city. In our stories, they destroyed the place, they burnt it to the ground, and the Romans came to within a hair's breadth of considering abandoning the site altogether and moving somewhere else. In other words, this was, in our sources, it's presented as an absolute catastrophe. But in a wonderful twist, it's presented as a heroic catastrophe, in the same way that many cultures will turn an abject failure into something noble, in the sense of, in our worst hour, we displayed many of our greatest traits. If we think of the Second World War, the disaster at Dunkirk served that function for Britain, the Battle of Gettysburg for the Confederates in the south and so forth, the Siege of Masada for the ancient Israelites and the modern Israelis alike. The notion of the heroic failure is quite a powerful one, and the Gallic catastrophe is one of several Roman heroic failures. The stories surrounding the Gala catastrophe are well worth telling. I wish I had the time to share them all with you, but there are all kinds of wonderful vignettes and images from this event that have come down to us from the sources. I just picked two of my favourites. As the people are evacuating Rome, fleeing out of the gates to get away, after news has come that army at the Allia has been crushed and the Gauls are coming onto the city, a simple plebeian, a man called Albinius, we are told, takes his family in a cart, but seeing the Vestal Virgins carrying the sacred objects from the hearth of Rome with them, he takes pity on them, takes his family out of the cart, puts the Vestals in with the sacred objects, and allows them to be driven in style to refuge in the nearby town. Or even better, the aged, imperious Roman nobles, who, too old to fight, refuse to enter into the last stand of the Capitoline Hill, where the young men have decided to make their last stand against the Gallic attack. This is the fortress inside the city of Rome itself. They refuse to go in since they don't want to stretch the resources, the already strained resources of the town that maybe threaten the effectiveness of the defence. So they stay in their houses, sitting in the vestibules of their houses in full stately regalia and await the onslaught of the Gauls. There's a superb moment described where one nobleman, Marcus Papirius by name, is sitting in his house in his full gear, and the Gaul, a Gallic band, comes into his house. You must imagine these men, the Gauls fought naked with mud in their hair, spiked out. They would have looked like even more frightening than the punks do today, only armed with enormously long swords and extremely aggressive attitudes. The Romans by stature were quite small people. So here we have this large Gallic band of warriors coming forward, and Papirius stands up looking down his nose at them, and the Gaul comes over and tugs on Papirius's beard, for which he gets slapped across the face for his insolence, which prompts the Gauls then to slaughter Papirius and his family where they stood. Great images of Roman sense of superiority. Must be said, however, that excavations at Rome have failed to verify the widespread destruction at this time. If their city was burnt to the ground, there's no sign of it in the archaeological record. And so most scholars today believe that what happened was the Gauls came to Rome, looted the place, certainly ransacked it, were perhaps bought off with a large bribe, and then left. The Gauls weren't interested in occupying Rome, they just wanted some loot. The Gallic raid then humiliated the Romans, but didn't seem to have greatly deterred them from their chosen course of expansion over their neighbours. In the years following the Gallic raid, they built a 7-mile stretch of walls around their city. This is not a sign, by the way, that the Romans were not as devastated by the Gallic catastrophe as they would have us believe. It's not the act of a defeated and crushed people to build a large stone fortification 7 miles in circumference around their town. Clearly, Roman power hadn't been broken, even if the Romans had lost considerable face by the incident. Without going into the detail, Roman incursions into Etruria to the north and Latium to the south continued, and relations with the Latins reached a peak in the so-called Latin War of 341 to 338 BC, which finally saw the Romans establish control over their Latin neighbours. They were now, by the date 338 BC, we can now say that the Romans have conquered and absorbed the Latins. With their control over Latium now secured, the Romans turned their attention to their southern western flank, where they found the Samnites. The Samnites were a formidable opponent. They were one of those Iron Age tribal cultures that we talked about earlier in this course. They were a warrior society. They were tough fighters, as mountain men tend to be throughout history, and they had initially signed a non-aggression pact with the Romans, but had then turned their attention, this is the Samnites, they had turned their attention to raiding into the area of Campania. In other words, the plain further south from Rome, the plain around Naples. Raiding into Campania resulted in the locals in that area appealing to Rome, which is an interesting fact. It seems now that Rome was being recognized as a force to be reckoned with in the Italian geopolitical scene. So when the Campanians felt pressed, they appealed to Rome for assistance. And in 343, the First Samnite War took place. It lasted only 2 years and was rather an indecisive affair, resulted only in a renewal of the Romano-Samnite Treaty of some years previously. However, with Roman control over Latium, and now with something of a foothold among the Campanians in the south, the Romans began to extend their powers around the borders of traditional Samnite territory. They did so predominantly by founding cities and colonies right at the edge of Samnite territory, squeezing the Samnites somewhat, putting them under pressure. The Samnites weren't blind to this, and as a result, in 326 BC, the Great, our second Samnite War, broke out. This was the most serious conflict that the Romans had fought to date. It lasted over 20 years. It was a tumultuous struggle and saw the Romans sharply defeated a number of fronts, but continuously coming back